Wednesday, July 12th, Data Protection Breakfast Club, a production of TechGC.
TechGC.
Here we are.
Thank you, TechGC.
Thank you, Chris Sands, wherever you are.
Yeah,
Ali, wherever you are.
Yeah, they're international men of mystery, man.
Yes, like, I love these guys.
Yeah. They really do the heavy lifting. Like me and you just come out here and do the circus. They do the hard work of making us sound reasonably sane, which I think is hard.
Thank you to those guys so much. Dude, what an episode today. We had Dennis.
I'm very biased because I love Dennis.
Can I jump in for a second? Because I don't know him until today, other than you saying that Dennis Ali was my mentor at Carlton Fields, a law firm in Florida. This might be top five favorite conversations. I just like that we talk sometimes about like bringing your whole self, you know? And I love when someone isn't afraid to bring their whole self to their practice of law, their life. It's all one big soup pot, man, you know? And this is a really, really interesting conversation.
Yeah.
You know,
Dennis is a fully realized human being. Okay. Like he is got all the legal pedigrees and all the experience and has done all the hard things that make you a good lawyer. He's been practicing law almost 50 years. He knows what he's doing. And no one in South Florida or in the U.S. that knows him or has worked with him or knows of his reputation doubts that. On top of that, like, he's just a profound person with wide interests, and he doesn't dabble. Like, when he doesn't know about something, he'll tell you. When he's a subject matter expert on something, he'll show you. And that's key. Like, he doesn't go around telling people he knows everything about butterflies and birds and South Florida ecology. You just can't walk away from a conversation with him not knowing that, because the depth is there. And on top of all of the just ability stuff, dude, he's a good man. He's a good guy who helps a lot of people. And I mean, he's got a fan club. Like, anytime I mention him on LinkedIn or on the podcast, I get a ping from somebody who I either knew or not don't know and says, dude, I feel the same way about Dennis. Like, he's a good guy, man. He's a fucking good guy. And I'm very lucky that I landed at Carlton Fields when he was the practice group leader of the group that I joined. And he sort of took me under wing. And we didn't talk a lot about this on the episode. He's a corporate lawyer by trade. But the reason that firm has a technology practice is his willingness to take a risk and allow me to do some dabbling and some expanding of the firm's practice under his supervision, obviously.
It's
and the,
so rare.
The partners. But he went and took the risk of saying, this fucking associate guy wants to go for it. I'm here. Let's go for it. And we went for it. And now they have a thriving practice and I have a thriving career. And it's because somebody in his position was willing to take a chance on, you know, some pretty bold ideas.
Yeah, that's so great. I'm trying to think if I have someone that had that large of an impact on me. And I'm not sure. I have a bunch of people that did, have significant impact, but, and people that believe in you are huge and crucial. That's great. He has some great thoughts on leadership, on hiring, on, client lawyer relationships, people. It's a really, really interesting conversation.
I'm really happy we were able to get him on here, man. And favorite episode of all time for me. Like, as a fanboy, but also as just someone who loves Dennis. And I mean that in the true sense of the word. Like, I'm just happy he joined us. So let's share it. And I think people are going to like it.
Sweet. Here it is. All right. Here we are.
We're here.
All right, Pedro. Dennis is here. Finally.
Finally. We did it. We did it, man. We did it. Dennis, I don't know. I'm sure you're busy and don't listen to this podcast very much. It's not very good anyway, so you're fine. But we talk about you on the podcast quite a bit, and we've had other guests like Steven, who you know, that are sort of in like the Dennis family tree of lawyers. And a lot of listeners have reached out to me and and said, I heard you mention Dennis Ollie and he did this for me or he did that for me or he's a great guy or whatever. So like you've got your own little cult following amongst our listeners. Obviously, I'm a big fan and Andy has become a fan over the years of hearing me talk about you. So we're really excited that you're here.
I appreciate it.
Definitely.
I'm a fan of mentors, you know, and we talk about our various mentors and people that helped us a lot. So that's exciting to have one of Pedro's, you know, favorite people here too. It's exciting. Yeah,
and you know what's crazy is Dennis is one of the few people who could, well, he was my boss at a law firm. Like I think he's him and Julie. You two are the only two people who can say that. And you know, rest in peace, Julie Ferguson, who was a great manager and a great lawyer as well. Yeah, like Dennis and I worked at the firm together for several years, and I've said many times on the podcast, like my real breakthrough into tech was through you, Dennis. It was when you picked up Prolexic as a client, right, and sort of like sent me their way. You want to talk a little bit about how like your corporate practice? Well, first of all, let's talk about your law career. Like, can you walk us through like how you got started, how you ended up in a corporate practice, and then how that turned into like a hybrid corporate tech practice around the time I was at the firm?
Sure. So I've practiced law now almost 47 years. I went to undergraduate school at Rice in Houston, and then Rice had a special program with Columbia where your senior year in college, you started your first year in law school. And then in your second year of law school, you completed your undergraduate degree by taking graduate school courses in your undergraduate major. So in reality, my degree is from Rice in 1975 and my law school degree is 1976, which everyone looks at and says, there's got to be a typographical mistake here. But in reality, I had a good time at Columbia, first time ever in New York City. And you can imagine a boy from South Texas, you know, my hometown had at the time 5,000 people. Now it's got about 2,000, but it was a long way to the Upper West Side and Morningside Heights and all that was going on in a different New York City. That was 1973. And you can imagine that was if you want to see what New York City was like, watch the French Connection movie. Okay. That was filmed, maybe a year before. New York was a pretty tough place all over, okay? And it was almost bankrupt. The government wouldn't bail them out, and they did, you know, a bond offering, and that rescued them. But the point is that I grew up fairly quickly going to law school in New York. Did not follow the normal course that most of my classmates all went to Wall Street, all the big firms that everybody knows. Different in the sense that they weren't so international in scope. They were mostly, they were downtown. They were Wall Street. And the Midtown exodus hadn't occurred yet. So I was sort of crazy because I was going to go get a job outside of New York. I interviewed the usual places. I actually clerked in Houston. I got married while I was in law school. My wife decided that Houston was not the place we wanted to live. So of all places, we moved to an outfit in Miami that I had no connection whatsoever. One of the few people that had no relative ever living in Miami. But I was intrigued by the law firm that I got to start with. It's a firm named Paul and Thompson. Doesn't exist anymore. It was about a dozen lawyers. They were all I was let in because I had a Columbia degree, but they were all Harvard and Yale lawyers. And of all places in Miami, Florida, which is a little odd. but I will give them credit because the two principals, Dan Paul and Parker Thompson, were, besides being great lawyers, they were community builders. And we'll talk about this later. Outside the practice of law, they really taught me the importance of pursuing some passion outside the law that's important to the community as a whole. And these guys were great mentors. That's even though I was only there about 3 years, and then left and started my own law firm with the senior partner, the managing partner of that firm, and had my name on the door after I was, you know, like 5 years out of law school, which was pretty unusual for people in my law school class. And Miami was a different place at the time. You could have a 12 or 15 person law firm and still get business from all over the country. And you didn't need to have 150 lawyers and 10 different offices, you know, throughout the country or the world, I should say. So anyway, I grew up in a small firm, now a small firm, that really emphasized, one, something we've lost in the law. When I would go in every day, I never knew what I was doing. You know, I did trust and estates, litigation, picked a jury, drafted a will, did a public offering, did some real estate, all in 1 year. Okay. I mean, it was...
That's malpractice now. Yeah, that's malpractice now.
It is. I know. It's unheard of. So I had the opportunity to be a generalist. And I got to see, you know, everything. I mean, the firm did everything, and the associate, you never knew. You know, it was, you guys are too young to remember the Johnny Carson show. There was a skit always on Johnny Carson, which was Stump the Band, which was someone would make up a name of some tune, and the band would have to figure out, you know, how the tune went. Of course, it was a joke. I mean, no one knew any of these songs. And so the band would just improvise and make something that sounded right. It was Stump the Band when you went in, each day, because you never knew what was going on.
Did you feel like that prepared you better, you know, doing all the variety?
And I'm not advocating that it can be done today. And I'm going to say something that sounds almost comical. There are more laws today. Okay. When I went to law school, there wasn't environmental law. Okay. Okay. Certainly nothing to do with technology. Okay. Environmental law was subsumed in administrative law. It was just one part of your, you know, the scope of what you had to know was so much more limited and much more, I'll say, fundamental. I'm not sure that's the right word, but, and transferable, you know, you learned how to litigate, learned how to, what lawyers do in litigation makes you a better corporate lawyer when the inevitable miscellaneous clause comes up of, dispute resolution. Okay. What do we really want? Arbitration? Do you know what arbitration means? You know, does it really save you money? I've been in arbitration. Okay. It may not save you money. It may be faster. You may not have an appeal. Does that matter to you? You know, those types of decisions, you're a better corporate lawyer if you understand all the things that can go wrong, and litigation is, you know, is one of those avenues. I think it's unfortunate that kind of training. I mean, some law firms did what I would call rotation, where you would rotate through, you know, you'd be in the corporate department, then you move to the real estate department, then you move to the trust and estates department. The problem is that's been disbanded. And now you're not only you're a corporate lawyer, you're not even a corporate lawyer, you're a 10B5-1 lawyer. Okay. And that's exactly all you do. Yeah. And that's really terrible. I mean, again, I don't mean to be an old guy, but I'm an old guy, and what law firms have become is they become anthills. And here's the reason: the anthill will survive. The individual ant is expendable. Okay. And that's the unfortunate nature of most big law firms.
That is a fascinatingly accurate and interesting analogy. And we talk a lot about this, and Andy's really passionate about like the law firm model and like its weaknesses. One thing you mentioned, you know, when we were joking about like malpractice and like the generalist lawyer in a law firm being no longer existent, Andy, it really interested in your thought about that as a general counsel, because general counsels sort of do what Dennis just described. You guys have to dabble in a lot of different areas. So like, how do you react to what Dennis just said about the law firm changing and becoming hyper-specialized, where really a general counsel is going in the other direction, I think?
It's a good question. I was going to say this. When you use that anthill analogy, Dennis, it called to mind a memory. I asked a lawyer a question at a law firm, and it was, in my view, a privacy question, but it certainly overlapped into tech transaction, commercial contract issue. And I asked him that question, and he couldn't answer it on his own. So he said, I'd like to bring in XYZ other partner. And that partner wasn't available for 2 weeks. You know, it's like, and I was like, how important is this person's opinion? You know, like, and I was a little disappointed in the fact that he couldn't answer that question for me. So what I did was I ended up going to another firm, to another lawyer who I know can kind of be a generalist and can kind of cross over more. So what happened was they ended up, you know, it wasn't a lucrative matter or anything, but I couldn't get the answer I needed. And so Pedro, it's difficult. It's disappointing. Yeah. I wish someone could. I don't know that everybody needs to, you know, necessarily litigate and do a will at the same time, but there's definitely natural overflow into significant areas that would feel a lot better if law firms would be able to kind of support a little bit more of that crossover. And I hope that isn't dead.
Yeah, I use it. I like the anthill example a lot because I think it's really emblematic of what the challenge is with like the humanity of law firms. You know, an example I use at work quite a bit is like, you know, we always hear in corporate talk, like, what's your swim lane? What's your thing? And my swim lane is privacy and your swim lane is, you know, M&A and like some specific niche in M&A, and somebody else's swim lane is general litigation. Another person's swim lane is like products litigation for medical devices. Like, you know, we've got all these swim lanes and we act like that's optimal, but it really isn't. Like Stephanie King, our friend, Andy, like came up with this like garden analogy, which I'm obsessed with. Like I'm literally obsessed with it, which is like, instead of approaching work as like a pool with lanes, like let's approach work as a garden where all of us have our specialties and somebody's an expert in flowers and somebody's an expert in mulch and somebody's an expert in this type of plant or this insect or whatever. But we're all sort of just collaborating together, handing each other the shovel when it's the right time. And we have our responsibility and we have our specialization, but it overlaps and complements the work that everybody else is doing. But most importantly, in a garden, everyone is within everyone else's line of sight. Like we are all in this together. The garden doesn't work if you fill it with, you know, one type of specialist or one type of dynamic. I think we're all sort of saying the same thing, which is it is no doubt that the law is more complicated, even in the 20 years or 15 years. Well, how long have I been practicing law? I don't even know, 16, 17 years that I've been practicing law. Definitely over your career, Dennis, it's changed completely and gotten more complicated and more specialized, more nuanced. But there still is an appetite, to your point, Andy, of like someone who has a general understanding of how things interoperate and how things interconnect. And like that, maybe that's a specialty in and of itself, which is who's the connector here who understands like enough about everything to know how to orient someone like Andy quickly so he doesn't have to wait 2 weeks for an answer that he needs this afternoon.
Yeah, it's a big challenge. I wish I could say that the law business is going in the right direction. I'm not sure it is. Although, you know, you get what you ask for, right? Andy, not throwing rocks at general counsel, but, you know, and I realize that the issues are often hyper specialized and with so many rules and laws, et cetera. And then you add an international aspect, you've got to have those specialists. But having the quarterback who can sort of have the big vision of the whole garden. Okay. And here's what we need to do today, right? We need to mulch over here. We need to trim the roses over here. Because if we don't trim the roses today, there's going to be a problem over here. That person that sort of understands that interconnectedness. And look, we all know you don't come out of law school with that capability. It requires some people acquire it, takes them a long time. And they, like me, they learn it the hard way. But you learn it. And I don't know if there's an opportunity. You know, it would be interesting to see if a law firm would accept the challenge of having rotating assignments. I think it devolved into summer clerks did that. But I think I don't even know what goes on in summer clerk programs now. I've got a summer clerk joke that I can tell if you want me to. It's a challenge. And what I see is, getting back to, that's part of the, you know, the old folks need to be training the young ones about how to have that vision. And that's really the point is, have you thought about this? How does this particular one issue fit into the bigger problem? And to pick up on Andy's point, you know, what's the saying? You can have it fast, you can have it cheap, or you can have it perfect. Pick any two. Right? And I'm not suggesting that ever you would do a client where use the word perfect. But, you know, sometimes clients say, I need an answer now. Okay. Give me your best guess. I don't want to use that word, but your best guess. Or how much is it going to cost? Hey, I'm willing to pay. I love these clients. I'm willing to pay anything. Unfortunately, they're disappearing now. Okay. And usually the second legal bill takes care of that. Okay. I found that it's a matter of principle. Yeah. It's principle until you get the second legal bill. And then suddenly it's, it's just business.
Let's talk about money.
Right. It's just money. Okay. It's just money. My duty is, to train younger lawyers to have the benefit of what I've learned along the way to help them. And that's really the key to leadership is it's not how good of a leader you are, it's how good are the people that you train. How good are they? That's the real measure.
Can I ask a question about training? Because I had very poor training in my law firm experience. And I as an example, right, one of the outside counsel that I will go to frequently was in-house for a period of time and then went back into law firms. So that's helpful that he understands what it's like to sit in that chair in the business. I'm always curious about how lawyers that haven't been in a company, and there are many that are still really successful at reading the very pragmatic things that the client needs from their business, and how do you do that and then train, the associates to kind of do that? Because that's really where the magic happens, I think. You know, we can all find a lawyer that knows the law pretty well, especially in a particular area. But that's, to me, where you really start making valuable client relationships to me.
Yeah, well, the not so old adage, but you hear about it a lot now is, make sure you understand the client's business. Okay, well, everyone says that, I don't know if I can say this, but it's like the no asshole rule. Oh, well, we hire lawyers, but we don't hire ass. Right. Yeah, everyone says that. But guess what? You end up with them anyway. Okay. The question is, what do you do when you have one? Okay. Understanding the client's business. I'll tell you how it starts. It starts by reading. Okay. And whether it's the industry or whether it's just general, I only skim, but it's like three newspapers a day. But if I see something that is relevant to a client, guess what? The best client advertising, as far as I'm concerned, marketing, is sending them an article. Hey, look at this. It's right on point of something you're doing. Or better yet, it's not something you're doing. It's something you should be doing or something you need to worry about. Okay. I was just thinking about you. Okay?
Even a question is good.
Can I give an anecdote about how that plays out in real life as one of Dennis's associates? Because as I've been one, I can't tell you how many mornings I walked into my office and on my desk was a printout or a newspaper clipping or something interesting about some issue that I had mentioned to Dennis weeks earlier about one thing or another or some conversation about a client need or demand that had happened at some point or another. And there I would come in the morning and the newspaper clipping would be waiting for me. So like Dennis, like even obviously it's good marketing, but it's also good training because what it taught me was to like, when I do read broadly, zero in on the things that really matter to me and go deeper, but also share information, just share it. Like I am not an expert at like corporate M&A stuff, but like your partner, Carlos Mas, one of the great lawyers I've worked with too, who I really respect and admire. I'd send him shit that I didn't really understand well, but it caught my eye and I'd heard him mention it or whatever. And he'd do the same with me, having no real depth in the areas that I worked in. So it not only sows, to use a Threads analogy, it sows good relationships and closer partnerships. But to your point, I think it's also great marketing with the clients just to let them know you're thinking about them. Like I'm thinking about you, man. This seems relevant to you. I'm thinking about you. It works.
Yeah, I don't know, Andy. I don't know that there's the several firms I've been in with, I've been associated with, starting with the first one, which of course was so small, it was a different world. The concept of training was just simply, you're there, right? We're going to a hearing now, and you're going to see what it's like, okay? And I wish I could say that there's a magic bullet on this when there isn't. I guess it's firms now have gotten to this idea. Well, we'll assign a mentor, which will be a senior lawyer, and they'll sort of look after this person. And, there's sort of the standing relationship. I guess as a default, that's fine. But if that's all you're doing, then you're not really training anybody. It's like checking a box. Okay. Yeah. We got a mentor program and And, you know, Andy's the mentor for Julie. Well, it's only as good as Andy's prepared to be committed to doing that.
Exactly.
And it's almost like it reminds me of the old, I just used this the other day. There is something worse than not having a rule, and that is having a rule and not obeying it. Okay. So that's why I tell my corporate clients, you can, yes, I encourage you to have good corporate hygiene and to have this policy in place, but you've got to follow the policy, because there is something worse than not having a policy. And that is having it, but no one honoring it. Okay. That was the escapades that have happened, you know, in corporate America in the past. You can have all the rules, all the boxes checked, but if the people aren't being trained, it doesn't matter. Okay. In fact, it's worse.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. So I guess my response is, yeah, it's an informal training. People sort of find out who they like working with. And my idea is people coming, look, Pedro's an example. He was hired as an immigration lawyer of all things. Right. I mean, and you're right. Julie, one of the great immigration lawyers, God rest her soul, happened to sit on the same floor that I did. And every Friday evening, we would have a drink in my office. Okay. I'd invite a handful of people to come in and we would, you know, have a glass and just talk about the afternoon of that week. What happened? What should we be doing? And it wasn't so much client things. It was just knowing each other. It was that, to use that word, culture, which unfortunately is being challenged now, because I guess the next thing to come up with is, how do you create culture in a remote circumstance? And it's not easy. Mm-hmm. And that's beyond my skill set. I can barely do it, but we have done it successfully here. And I think I've been relatively successful in that face-to-face, let's go do this together, right? Let's talk about, we don't have to be, you know, we don't have to have lunch together all the time. We don't have to see each other every day, but there has to be a germ or a foundation created. Once you've got that, I mean, this is a good example. I mean, Pedro and I haven't worked together in years. We still have a relationship. We know that we can text each other and know what we're talking about, what we're interested in. And, you know, that's the one good thing about the availability of information. It is, you know, it's drinking out of a fire hose, but it's there.
Yeah.
And if you want to, there's nothing better than to, again, reach out to a client or reach out to somebody that you've worked with and send them an article that you read, or, hey, I'm reading this book and I thought about you, because here's a chapter right on point.
I love this discussion. I love that you also, you can see, you know, from your office that you have a lot of things that are personal to you in your office. And, you know, that isn't unfortunately all that common right now. And you mentioned having a drink with folks and talking about your dog, which, you know, your day, whatever you're doing that weekend, even what, then it mixes into what you're doing at work. It's, how do you, you obviously value like the stuff you care about personally. And so how's that like come into your work and in and out of it? And you allow that to happen, obviously, on for a reason.
Yeah. So first of all, yeah, this is sort of the Museum of Natural History South. Okay. Which I describe it. And it's a great entertaining value, because when my colleagues bring their children in, they end up in here, you know, and you can't see off screen.
Dennis's office is a huge hit and then the building.
Yeah.
Folks that aren't going to see the video, let me describe the office for a second. There, and I'm not going to use the right terminology, but there is a lot of animal memorabilia and visual specimens in the office. So I can see butterflies over your shoulder. There's a, what is the boar?
Yeah,
like?
The javelina. Yeah, the javelina.
Un jabalí, as we would say in Spanish, is sitting there behind you. All the butterflies, the birds. I see the horns in the back. I mean, a lot of, you know, animal stuff. And Dennis, and I don't say this lightly, is one of the great naturalists I've ever met, and is one of the foremost experts, and I'm not using that term casually, on like Florida ecology, specifically South Florida. And I don't know of a single person who has more knowledge about birds than Dennis Ollie. And like everyone I've introduced to Dennis in the context of a visit to the Everglades has said, there is not a living person that knows more about the Everglades than Dennis Ollie. And this is all, this is like feedback I've gotten, and I've also observed it. So I just want to give everyone listening some context. This is not like Dennis is casually interested in animals. Dennis is one of the foremost experts in like South Florida ecology, and it's not close.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Well, it's something I've been interested in. You know, I had the advantage, as I mentioned earlier, growing up in a small town in Texas, which was incredibly rural. And that helps to be surrounded by stuff. Had a mother who was a bird watcher, casual. So I've been watching birds for 65 years. And, you know, sooner or later, you learn something along the way. But more importantly, I went to law school where I didn't do any of that. It was sort of like, and then after law school and after starting working, sitting in an office, dealing with a bunch of lawyers every day, I realized, gee, nature is sort of a total release, okay, for me mentally. Besides being generally interested, I found it when you're in an office all day, going outside, and especially when you've got something like the Everglades, right? You know, literally just a 30-minute drive from you.
Down.
It's more subtle. You know, it's not Yosemite or the Grand Canyon, which are spectacular. I mean, you know, how can you not go to the Grand Canyon and look over the edge, much less go down the trails and not say, wow, Everglades, lot more subtle than that. But it's an interesting place. It's like no other place in North America, and it's a good tool. And this may be sort of to tie it back. What I find, whether it's bird watching or in my sense, just going out in nature, is when you go in groups with people, one, it's not a bunch of lawyers talking about legal stuff. It's people, you know, you never know where they're from. They could be a mechanic. They could be a president, the CEO. They could be in between job. You know, it's all, everyone's equal. Okay. You know, there's no hierarchy. Does one develop in terms of the ability to identify birds? You better believe it. Okay. But that's a different skill set, you know, and it's a totally different skill set than talking on the telephone and arguing with lawyers and clients, right? It's a very different skill set. And I think probably good therapy, actually, you know, it's something that makes you think that the parts of your brain that you don't otherwise use. I also find that it's a good, when I go with groups, I learn stuff. You know, it's great. You go to bird walk, but the guy next to you is a spider expert. And the woman over here knows all about moths, okay, diurnal moths. It's incredible. I mean, that's the way you learn, in the field with somebody that knows what they're doing. And wow, it's like free education. And
it's no different than lawyering,
right,
to be honest.
Right.
I mean, you can be trained, but that the best way is to be with someone who's actually mentoring you in the how and answering the questions organically as they go through. And, you know, I had this one thing happen to me and this is how I dealt with it. And that's not how you're going to deal with it every time, but it's instructive of how
it's,
we grow.
Well, Dennis, I do want to say, like, definitely going to ping you again in December to do what we did last December. And anyone listening who's interested in tagging along can ping me, because Dennis took a group of my friends on I hate to use the term field trip because it sounds goofy, but on a field day to the Everglades. And like the group of friends was like an electrical and computer engineer, a woman who works in like industrial engineering at a refrigeration company, me, and like a Pulitzer Prize winning war correspondent. Like, this is the group of people that went with Dennis on this field day. And we met early in the morning and we were there till deep in the afternoon, and it was a profound day for my friends. Like, they are still talking about it. We have a chat thread about it. Like,
That's awesome.
Is an amazing, amazing thing to do, to visit the Everglades with you, Dennis. And I'm really excited to do it again in December if you will.
Dennis, what's your role with the Audubon Society as well as the Butterfly Association? Like, you have like formal leadership roles too.
Yeah, so I've been a member of Tropical for 45 years. I was the president for about 4 or 5 years now, 20 plus years ago, on the board for 30 years. I'm now on the so-called advisory board, which is sort of emeritus, and I, my own self-style, not chief of staff, but I have the ear of the president. How is that? So he and I talk about,
nice,
you know, what I think should be done, and I don't have to absorb the slings and arrows of being the person who actually announces the decision, but it's a good thing for me. I'm a recovering birder, as they say. So I've got into butterflies about 20 plus years ago. And in a way, sort of the same people, most people that are into butterflies or bird watchers as well. But once again, it, in my mind, it's not about counting and having a list. I do keep a list. Of course, people keep lists, but it's about understanding the bigger picture of nature and what's out there, what's happening. And, you know, birds are a good example. Butterflies, maybe even slightly better example of what is going on in the environment. And one, it's an excuse to get out and do things. And that's really important, I think, from not just for lawyers, because of the nature of what the work they have to do. I think it's important. I'll tell you, the other people it's important for is children, to get them out and see that aspect of seeing nature. And the sooner they get that opportunity, in my opinion, the better, because it gives them a sense of, one, proportion. What does it mean to be part of the world? And it's not just a bunch of cities and other human beings. There's a lot of other life in this world that, you know, we're entrusted with. And, you know, part of protecting things is loving it, and loving it is understanding it. Sort of use the Jacques Cousteau analogy backwards. But, you know, people don't, they don't go and they don't understand, then they're not, they don't appreciate it. They don't appreciate it, they're not going to protect it. That's my sense is, and the good thing about the Everglades is once you are with people, and it's great to go with people with different skill sets. I know nothing about photography. I know two things about photography. One, when I go in the field, I like to have a photographer with me. And two, whenever, and this is the best, important piece of free advice you're getting from me. When you see a good photograph, you never, ever compliment the camera. Okay. You don't say, "Wow, Pedro, what a great camera you've got." That is the biggest offense you could ever give to a photographer. You say that you are a spectacular photographer. That is a great, not "what a great camera. What kind of camera are you?" Don't ever do that. I learned that lesson the hard way, but I learned it. Okay. That when you are impressed with a photograph, you compliment the photographer. Okay. Has nothing to do with
very
the equipment.
Nice.
Anyway, I digress. The point is, nature has been important for me. And I guess that to back all the way up, when I look at young people coming in, my question is, what's your passion? You know, what are you interested in? In fact, I make a joke with my colleagues that everybody looks, "Oh, well, what law school did they go to?" I go all the way down to, because you know how resumes are the same everywhere, right? You go to the very bottom of the resume and it says interests or something like that. And it's, that's where I go. Okay. What are you interested in? And what do you tell? Oh, reading and, cooking. Well, right. What are you really interested in? Okay. Tell me, what is your passion in life? All right.
Another anecdote, because I love this. When I was interviewing for the firm, the last interview was with Dennis because he was the head of the practice group. And so I walked into his office for the first time, and it was obviously, my senses were stimulated because there's so much stuff going on in there, in a very beautiful and like sort of like nature oriented way. We sat down and like, look, just to demonstrate that what like the words coming out of your mouth aren't empty words. You didn't ask me about my fancy job at the Justice Department. You didn't ask me about, you know, some of the highlights of the resume that sort of stand out and make me unique. Like the first question I remember you asking me was, "What are you reading? Like, what are you reading right now?" And I don't remember what I was reading, but I told you about it. And then somehow the conversation evolved into like making fun of Thomas Pynchon. I think it was Gravity's Rainbow we were picking on, one of these like obscure books that, like, you know, and I honestly, like, I think it was like you not testing, but like probing whether I really was a voracious reader. Cause like, if you are, you're going to know who Thomas Pynchon is. But like, also, like, it created a service for us to talk about on that is actually unique to me, not like my job or the school I went to. Lots of people have that job and went to those schools, but like reading is something I really, really deeply cared about. And like, I don't know a more voracious reader than you. I really don't. Every time I try to send you a fucking book, you're like, "That was a great book. I read it." you really, I've always had an appetite for reading, but man, have I doubled down on it, because like, first of all, being quiet is hard for me, and reading helps me do that. And then I think
when you, Dennis, when you do that, when you do what you did, the way you described it and the way you asked a particular question of Pedro in an interview, like, what do you, I think I get it, but can you go a little deeper? Like, what are you looking for? And what are you looking for when you see an associate that you feel like, all right, this kid's got real promise to be really, really good at this in the roundest sense possible. What are you looking for?
Yeah, that's a surprisingly difficult question to answer because sometimes I don't even know. But I guess to use that word I used earlier, a passion for something. Okay. You got to have otherwise what on earth are you doing in this world? Okay. And, yeah. And how are you going to make it better? And again, I don't by any means have a monopoly on that. I mean, for example, technology, whatever that means. I mean, we have a technology committee. I mean, that's like saying, well, we've got a lawyer committee. I mean, it's like, I'm a lawyer. Well, what does that mean? Okay. What kind of lawyer? Anyway, I guess I'm rambling here, but I look for potential, and it's a little bit like, the people that I'll say admire the most, that probably is not the right word, that I am intrigued about are scouts, people who can identify the left-handed pitcher in high school that's going to make it in the pros, okay? I don't know how they do it, okay? And I know there's all types of metrics and things like that. There's an issue whole now about, data gathering and what does that mean. Baseball is, of course, the best example, but it's not the only one. How do you pick that next person that's going to be really good at being a lawyer? And I mean, God, if I knew exactly how to do that, I'd bottle it. But the passion, the commitment to, I'll say, reading or knowledge, the acquisition of knowledge, okay, that they're not content with whatever they're doing. I want to learn more about X. I almost don't care what it is, okay, because whatever it is, it probably has a relation to something else that we're already doing. Okay. And that's the one good thing about what's happened in this world is things are now, even though there's more information, data, requirements, laws out there, they're all more interconnected than ever. Okay. And it's surprising. If you can teach somebody how to practice law by analogy, that's probably 90%. Yeah. Yes, you need to go find the specific statute so I can give Andy the exact answer to make sure there's something out there. There's not something out there that says this is illegal. Okay. But otherwise, it's by analogy. Okay. You train by analogy. One of the Marine Corps principles, right? I'll send this to you guys. There's a book called Core Principles, and it's the Marine Corps, and I was not in the military, but it's a book about how the Marines train, and it's like 30 principles that they adopt. It seems like a unusually large amount, but one of them is training by analogy. You can't train for everything. You can't know every law and every rule, but you can remember an experience that's similar to the one you had. Okay. Are we going that way? I'm sort of off topic, but the capability of is somebody, they have a passion, are they trainable? And I don't mean that they have to sit here and listen to me lecture. Is it something that they have that trainability goes into a natural inquisitiveness? One of the problems is you get smart people who are doing that, and quite often they realize, I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to be something else. And okay, I get it, right? I get it.
You've used the word passion a bunch, and you've used inquisitive. I think other guests that we've talked about, Ann Bradley was this former chief privacy officer at Nike. The whole episode almost was about curiosity.
Yep. Yep.
And I do a whole lot of thinking about curiosity when I'm hiring, and you nailed it, Dennis. Like, it's a work in progress. Hiring is one of the hardest things there is. And it's just this continuum over time that you hope you get better at. And I think one of the things is looking for curiosity, and I love passion, adding that to like the layer of kind of layers of kind of things we're looking for when we talk to people and kind of try to get to know them and figure out if they're going to be like a really good fit for what we're looking
for. It's hard to do in a 30-minute interview. I am not a particularly good interviewer. I mean, the reason I know that is because I've seen some of my colleagues who are really good. I mean, they, and it's not the usual in your face type thing, or it's not the, I recall the probably made up apocryphal story of the McKinsey interview where they bring the guy in and it's a chair, but one leg of the chair is slightly shorter than the other three, just so he's off balance, you know. And how did he...
or the locked right. window when they say it's hot in here, we open right. the window
exactly just to start the whole set the framework that you know that things are not going well, right? I don't do that, but it's not an easy thing to do. Interviewing is hard, and you are, you know, it's not like you have a lot of. Yeah, there's data out there, but it's not often not useful. And I'd like to think that, and maybe this is the point of collaboration among within law firms is, you know, get different types of people to hire to be the interviewers. And I don't, Pedro, were you around when the late Seth Joseph was part of the law firm?
Yeah.
Seth I remember was, Seth, yeah. you know,
rest in peace, Seth. Yeah.
I mean, a difficult person, prickly personality.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't smart, really smart guy. And it was like, you know, what did Seth think? You know, I may not agree with him. Okay. But just how did people behave in front of him? And he wasn't a jerk. He was just, he approached the practice of law differently. And he and I got along tremendously. And it pointed out to me that, you know, there's not one uniform way to do that type of recruiting. Yeah. It is a collaborative effort, and it is much more difficult than it sounds. And unfortunately, what's happened is that. It's become sort of just hire them, and because you know what, they're ants, and
the ant hill.
Right, we'll get if they don't work, they don't work. In the meantime, they're just initials on a bill. Somebody's got to read all that stuff. And, you know, it's a total disservice to those. I'm just shocked at how, maybe I'm not, I mean, money talks, I get that, but how the idea of thinking, I guess my metaphor is good pool players, and I'm not at all, good pool players, anyone can sink that shot. Where's the cue ball going to be after you make that shot? That's what good pool players are, okay? They think about the next step or the next two steps, okay?
I love that.
That's really
good. That's the Wayne Gretzky.
Right. Skate to where it's going
skate
to
where the puck
is absolutely. Going. Right. And, yeah. I love that. It sounds, you know, sort of comical in that, but to think about that and whether it's in hiring, okay, where's this person going to fit? Are they going to fit in? You know, what can I do for them to make them successful? You know, the old help me help you, right? help me help you. And, you know,
I know we're running out of time, but I don't want to end without asking you, Dennis, what are you reading right now?
All right. Well, I just finished. I went down the rabbit hole of 17th century England. Okay. And so there are two books.
That sounds like a really big rabbit hole.
No. There are two books that you both should read. One is, it's an old book. It's been out for 10 or 15 years called God's Secretaries. It's about the writing of the King James Bible. Not so much about the Bible, but about what was going on in England at the time, which led me to a book that just was published called The Blazing World, which is also now, not just about the King James Bible, which was 1603 to 1611. It's about King James through the Glorious Revolution. And just so you remember, James, you know, Charles I, who gets his head cut off, okay? Oliver Cromwell, Charles II, you know, there's a whole dynamic. And what went on in England at that time is, and of course, there are little things that happened, you know, Plymouth Rock, the separatists.
Just a little thing.
Yeah, I mean, the founding of our country are basically the malcontents that couldn't make it in what was a hyper-religious environment. Blazing World, man, it is quite something. So I just finished that. I started a book because my children and grandchildren live out in Northern California, and I was listening to an NPR podcast about geology, and there's a book called Deep Oakland, and it talks about the geology of the East Bay and how that geology, you know, geology rules the world. It just does it in a slow fashion. Okay. So that's the one I'm reading now, and I've got a new one. And the one I'm because you guys were asking me about it, I actually brought a prop. This is the single most important book that, in terms of leadership, you should have on your chair. It's called
The Art of Leadership.
The Art of Leadership. Okay. And
by Matt, what's his name? Max Dupree.
Max Dupree.
It's easy read, but you know, everyone should read through it.
Well, you've never failed me on recommending a book. So for everyone listening, if you want a book on leadership, you should read the one Dennis just mentioned.
I also love the reference to geology, because like lawyers are so insignificant compared to geology.
Man. Like we're not. What we're doing is so irrelevant. I heard this quote about Jeff Bezos, and I think about it every day. And it's like, Jeff Bezos may be the richest man in the world and all these other things, but he'll never be the ocean.
Right.
And lawyers will never be the ocean, you guys. Right. Like, we're just some administrative bureaucratic types, okay? Right. Like, that's just what we're doing here.
We're out here having fun. Right. Yeah.
So anyway, I recommend Deep Oakland only, even if you don't know about Oakland, because it's more about just that point, which is how irrelevant, you know, a lot of what we do how important and how visible a lot of this is. And all it takes is, I want to go on a field trip with this guy, okay, the author, because.
Well, you should write to him. I'm sure he'll take your offer and take you up on the invitation. Yeah. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us, man. It is an honor for me to have you on the podcast. I am really very grateful to you for a lot of what you've done for me and my own career and my ability to be in the position that I'm in today. And I give you your flowers as often as I can. But I think it's important for me to tell you here in this forum that Andy and I have created just how grateful and indebted to you I am as a professional and as a man. And thanks for joining us, man.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been nothing but a pleasure. It makes me feel good to hear that. And I know that I've maybe a little bit of success, because that's how you're remembered, is not by the documents you draft, but by the people that, you know, that you train and collaborate with. And that, in my mind, is the real legacy of leadership.
Love it.
Well, thank you, Dennis.
Thank you so much.